You're listening to a Why Now podcast.
This is the Worldwide Will Show on whynow.co.uk. I'm your host, Will. I'm a British Army veteran of just short of 11 years and serve numerous tours of Afghanistan. In this show, I'll be speaking to former members of the British Armed Forces and Coalition Forces, giving them a platform of which to tell their life story, as well as experiences and how it's affected them. I hope you enjoy the show. All right, guys, welcome to the Worldwide Will Show. We're joined by Alex Smith, a.k.a. Smudges. Smudge, thanks for coming, bro.
No, thanks for having me, dude.
Yeah, that's good, So, for the listeners, Smudge and I go back quite a long way, back to probably, 2006, end of 2005, 2006. So we served in the same unit together. Unfortunately, we didn't serve any tours together, just because of the way the tours laid and the rotation. But we did work together, contracting afterwards. And it was actually Smudge who got me onto the contract, so thanks, mate, you jack bastard. anyway, so we'll get the ball rolling. So where'd it start, bro?
Well, I grew up in a small town in the northeast called Bishop Auckland, and we later on moved to another town which I reside in now, Shildon, which is just down the road. Basically, my parents had split up when I was younger, and then later got back together. And because of the separation, they both ended up in separate places. Mm. So yeah, we decided to move to Shildon. Family got back together. My dad, being ex-forces, he had a couple of issues in himself, done like various tours in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, is that during the Troubles, is it?
Yeah. It was back in the 70s.
Yeah.
So he did like three or four tours of Ireland back then. He was pretty much verging on, you know, becoming an alcoholic and stuff.
Yeah.
And that's what kind of made my parents split up.
Yeah.
My dad's troubles. And then all of a sudden, he changed overnight. Like, he'd stopped drinking.
Wow.
During the separation, I think they were separated for about a year, and I lived with my mum. But yeah, he stopped drinking. And it was all through, like, going to church and that. So that kind of changed him.
Was he quite a religious man before that or not?
No, not that I remember. Yeah, so religion changed him.
Yeah.
I have my own views on that, but
sure,
it's changed him as a person and made him a better person.
Well, you know, each their own and that. And as long as it works for the best, then crack on.
But because of my dad and his military photos, and there's like a couple of old school black and white photos kicking around in family albums of him in Northern Ireland and that, that kind of decided my sort of where I'd want to be in life and what I wanted to do. So from an early age, I wanted to join the army.
Had he got out before you were born?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was born in September 82. He got out roughly around about the start of 82.
Right.
As a family, we had a bit of a rough one, sort of, growing up.
Well, I mean, as you know, it's not easy getting out. So, you know, I can't imagine having a child in the first year of Civvy Street. Because, fucking hell, I've only just got used to Civvy Street now, and it's been 6 years.
Carnage. Like, I think we all go through it as, with the transition of coming from the military to Civvy Street. And obviously, others come out with other issues.
But
went through school, like, not giving a fuck. And it was like, I know what I want to do.
Yeah.
I just fucking...
So you had your mindset on the army from the start then?
I ended up going to training sort of, when was it? It was kind of like January 2000. I went down to Bazenbourne.
Right.
Originally, I was supposed to go Royal Regiment of Fusiliers. Fucking banking.
We love you, really. We love you guys, really.
We got taken to a couple of briefs in the theatre.
Is that because it's a local regiment up here, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of like 2nd Battalion, Royal Regiment, Fusiliers and the Rifles and things like that.
Yeah.
And then when you get into training, you get like various briefs, you know, like you get like the SF briefs and all that shit. And 473 Battery, I remember seeing this video and I was just like, oh my God.
That is Gucci.
I was like, right, I want to do that. I want to do that. And I ended up changing cap badges. My platoon sergeant at the time, and funny enough, he's... his name was Payne, Sergeant Payne.
What's the alias name in the world?
Yeah, but I remember him saying, "Don't fucking do it. It's all arms. You know, go to battalion,
do
your fucking thing, and then crack on. You know, if you want to go do that, do that." And it was kind of like a bit of advice that I wished I'd taken at that time.
Yeah,
but you can't sort of turn the clocks back. Left training, went to phase two, rattled through with that, and ended up in 5 regiment, expecting to go straight onto this fucking horrendous course. Mm-hmm. And I ended up in fucking 5 regiment, in QHQ battery. It was so disappointing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it was good. I got to meet some awesome people. Yeah, yeah.
What were they? What did they do?
So Q Battery were basically the regimental...
the headquarters?
Yeah, it was the regimental headquarters battery. Oh,
yeah.
They did some Gucci stuff. I got to regiment, fitted in pretty quick because of my mindset and stuff.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, stay with Q, you know, get your fitness and this and that, and then go over to 473.
Mm.
Did my Arctic Warfare course.
Mm.
Spent 3 months in Norway. Did my Arctic Warfare course, and then I went on and did an exercise out there, and just fucking lapping it up.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and then after that, 9/11 happened.
Yeah.
And everyone's gearing up. The regiment's gearing up to go out.
Yeah.
Start doing pre-deployment training, and I get taken off it. They're like, Aunt Orridge pulls me in. He's like, so, do you want to go do 473? I was like, fuck yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they took me off it. They took me off that sort of deployment. The regiment didn't end up going anywhere.
Yeah,
but
yeah, yeah.
I took myself off it, and I ended up on the course.
Yeah.
So the first one I failed, pulled myself off it.
Yeah.
I got 2 advanced patrols.
Really?
Yeah. At that time, I'd just met my wife, Claire.
Yeah.
Or, you know, we'd been seeing each other on and off. I went on advanced patrols and my head wasn't in it, and I just sort of pulled myself off.
I was going to say, it's a weird part of the selection course to pull yourself off, because not all the hard work's done, but the majority of the hard work's done, you know?
Yeah, 3/4 of the way there.
Yeah.
My mindset had changed, me and my missus.
Yeah.
It was around about 2003, and I was like, oh, I'm going to sign off.
Oh, wow.
And I just pottered around in Q Battery.
Yeah.
Went and did my Lance Jacks course, got promoted, and I was like, is this what I want to do?
So for the listeners, that's is sort of the first promotional course to get Lance Corporal or Lance Bombardier, or, you know, whatever sort of corps you're in, to get the first promotion.
Yeah, so did that, did all the build up to get promoted, so getting the relevant qualifications like your signals level 2 and shit.
Yeah.
Got promoted, and then my mindset changed. I wanted to get out. My wife had fell pregnant with our first sort of child, summer.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I want to get out. And then I don't know what happened. I had the urge. I think I was on the regimental biathlon team at the time.
All right.
It was like me, Lloyd Murray,
who
was like an officer at the time over there, one of the troopies, and a couple of others.
Yeah.
And that was it. Fucking, they converted me. I got groomed to go back. And it was December at this time, and the next selection started in January. No fizz, no nothing.
Holy
just like
shit. No prep.
Just pure fucking, like the biathlon, nobody took it serious. There was like, it was like a fucking, like a serious sort of thing, you know what I mean? Yeah. At the time, everybody was prepping the skis and that. And we rock up like fucking half cut and everything. Just, I remember Cyanin, I think we'd been on the piss or something, and he'd come back, done no fucking ski prep, and just threw clister on his skis, which is like this fucking, it's like in a paste.
Yeah, yeah.
Threw that on. And I remember passing him on the course, and he had like these like,
huge clumps of
huge clumps of snow on the bottom of his skis running round. It was so funny, man.
He's an absolute maniac.
Yeah. So I didn't take that serious, I had no fizz prep or anything, got back, had a week, and that was it. I came back and I was on selection again. Wife thought I was mental.
Yeah.
And she was like heavily pregnant at the time. So this is now 2005.
Yeah.
When you go through training and you know, you go through all your range packages and things like that, and you've got it all in your head on how it's all gonna play out, and you feel invincible and shit.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get out of Herrick And next minute, I felt fucking small, and
yep.
I'm like, oh, what the fuck am I doing here? And I remember feeling quite emotional leaving my yeah. first tour and leaving my family. And mm-hmm. after the first night, first day on the ground,
yeah.
I just felt, I was like, fuck, this is
real.
6-7 months. There was a couple of things happened I won't get into, but yeah, it was like, Jesus.
Mm.
And then when it all fucking hit home big time was on the way back to Bastion. We got called back to Bastion to get retasked, and on the way back through, we had to go along the major highway, which was yep. route 1.
Yeah.
And there was a little town called Gresk.
Yeah.
It was the major town that we had to fucking breach through. And it was, I remember, we got to the outskirts of the town, got through, and it was like, yeah, fucking home and safe, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, fucking heard the most horrendous explosion you could ever hear. Never seen anything like, I remember turning around, the fireball was, you know, like the explosion was yeah. huge. And straight away, your fucking ass starts twitching. You're like, fuck, who is it? Mm. Who's hurt?
Who's been hit, yeah.
Yeah. But what had happened was a VBID, so a suicide bomber in a vehicle laden with explosives had clacked off on a call sign. So they tried ramming the vehicle, and yeah. I believe it was a Pinsgauer. So the Pinsgauer fucking literally rolled over the vehicle, this little shitty Toyota car. Yeah. And then we got the all clear. Like, everyone was good. It was pretty, it was pretty active.
Mm-hmm.
Tour fucking came to a slow finish towards the end. For that tour, the biggest hit that I was certainly around was when Daz got killed.
Yeah, Daz Gardner, yeah.
Daz Gardner. We got tasked to go do a patrol near Mount Doom,
mm-hmm.
which is on the northeastern side of Musicala.
Yeah.
And we drove up on a sort of reverse slope so the village couldn't see us.
Yeah.
And it was fucking freezing. We got our heads down for a couple of hours, and then we moved out our first light to do this patrol. And the ground was frozen, everything was just frozen. But when we come back, the sun had sort of set in the sky.
Yeah.
It was fucking quite warm.
Softened the ground a bit.
Yeah, so the ground's thawed out, and it was kind of like, it allowed you to move into a preset minefield and then sort of not get out of it.
Fuck.
And the first vehicle that got hit was about, it was Danny Kerr's vehicle. It was about fucking, say about 15 metres away from where I was at the
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm.
There was people closer to him, but literally just got the order to move, and he turned his vehicle and it fucking went up.
Fucking hell.
And it was kind of at that point, I didn't even know what was happening. All I remember is just like the explosion happening and just kit being spewed everywhere. And seconds afterwards, there was still stuff falling from the sky, like the bonnet with ammo boxes landed on top of our vehicle. And
fucking,
you know,
hell.
And I remember looking over at the vehicle, and I grabbed my med kit, as did, you know, like other people did as well. And I started running towards it, and I remember Boss McCaffrey at the time shouting, "Smudge, stop mines." So I fucking came to a halt and fucking shit myself. But yeah, we started to clean up for that. And I remember I was with Yam Yam, and we were carrying the 50 up there.
Yeah.
Put the 50 down at the Sergeant Major's vehicle, turned around, and we started our walk back to Air Troop.
Mm.
Got about fucking 50 metres away from it, not even that. Daz Gardner's truck starts to move, and then fucking boom, next fucking one goes hell. Up. So you turn around, you could actually see fucking Daz being blown stricken from the vehicle.
Yeah.
And then the vehicle lands on its side. And again, I always fucking remember kicking myself for this. It used to fucking hurt me, but I froze again.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until fucking Eddie Mayer moved past me that I'd fucking plucked up the courage to fucking do something and get involved.
Yeah.
And then after that, I remember looking at Paul, and I said to Paul, I was Daz, and he looked at me, and straight away, you just fucking know.
Yeah, you just knew.
Yeah, you just knew. We then cleared ourselves out of that area.
Yeah.
After getting all the casualties on the Hilo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was kind of like the real fucking major incident that I was involved in on that tour, and it's pretty shitty.
Yeah.
But after 7, came back, and I definitely noticed changes in myself.
Yeah.
100%. I can't remember what happened in between then. I did a couple of various courses back with the battery.
Your JTAC course?
Well, yeah. What happened was with that, I was tasked to go out on Hurric 12. So I would have been on her at 12, but what happened was one of the lads, Paul Allison, his missus, had fell pregnant. Mm-hmm. And I'd volunteered. I said, look, why don't I take your place? Mm. And then you can be home for the birth, and then you get to go out on 12, which is what happened. So I ended up banging out
places.
Yeah, doing my forward air controllers course.
Yeah.
So I did that, and then banged out on Herrick 11 with the boys.
Yeah.
Circumstances prior to leading up to this, like leading up to Herrick 6, I'd stopped drinking at the time.
Yeah.
So I think I was like sober for like 3 years.
Wow.
Go on Herrick 11, and I'm with Matty, yours, fucking Troy and George.
Yeah.
Lee Laughlin as well, and I end up drinking again.
Yeah, there's no way you could be in that team and not drink.
No. So I started drinking again. Yeah, Herrick 11 was... there was like new threats popping up. Obviously, yeah. Herrick 10 was horrendous with the threats, IED threats, the pressure plate IEDs. They got quite creative.
But the whole theatre had changed. So like the whole mindset of brigade, especially with in terms of like rules of engagement, that had changed. The threat had changed. So like someone just said there, the IED threat came in halfway through, maybe 2 months into my second tour, which was Herrick 10, which was the summer of 2009. So we had that to contend with, as well as the sort of rules of engagement changing. Do you notice a massive difference between the winter tour in 2007 and the winter tour 2009?
Yeah, definitely. So it was definitely more kinetic.
Yeah.
The Taliban were more active during that winter tour. So yeah, it went from a conventional sort of role where we were just fucking up, you know, having a good time to... shit, fucking can't move.
Getting blown up all the time.
Yeah, even blokes more. Getting hit. And the Taliban had more freedom of movement. Yeah. Then. So yeah, HR came out, integrated with them. And I was like literally on the ground with them for a month. And then all of a sudden we got the call, right, you boys need to go on leave. There was obviously a major op coming up and they wanted everybody out on leave. But I managed to get back with my with members of the my FST. Yeah. So I went back with Matty and Troy. Mm-hmm. So we all went on leave together and come back. And at that time, the HR had fucked off on leave. So I was like, right, this is it. I can get out on the ground with my boys. Yeah. So I'd gone off my own back to sort of get down into Nadi Ali with the boys, which I did. I got to spend a month. I got Christmas with my team.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
End of that too, I ended up back with a household calf back in Nadi Ali.
Yeah,
in a place called Bolan. Various things happened during that time. One in particular, we got tasked to do a patrol of Bolan T prior to establishing a patrol base there. And we had to push up there, do this clearance patrol and flush out the enemy. And that morning it all just kicked off. Like, straight from getting out of bed.
Yeah.
A scimitar had hit a fucking IED.
Yeah.
So there was a guy who'd lost his leg. So I was controlling the merc for that. But we were walking down this canal, east to west running canal, and straight away fucking we're in a linear ambush.
Brilliant.
To start off with. Opened up with fucking two PKMs or something.
Yeah.
I remember it was a long fucking burst from various PKMs and sniper fire, of which one guy got hit in the throat from the off, changing his magazine on a berm. Couldn't see the enemy because of them adopting their tactics. Merc came in with a Brit Apache, and that's when it all fucking changed for us. Brit Apache got stuck in. We had a single Apache. And because of the intensity of what was going on, he just got stuck in. And I was giving him, pointing him directions and, you know, doing talk-ons of where likely enemy positions were coming from. And we've got the PID, a lot of them.
Yeah.
Fucking Winchestered that Apache.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. So we Winchestered him.
Yeah.
For
the listeners that don't know what that means, it's where all munitions have run out because they've used all the ammo.
So it kind of like ended for us when a Hellfire dropped onto a compound. So we PID the sniper position.
Yeah.
Engaged it with its cannon, terminated the sniper, and then once the sniper got taken out, a Kazovac team went in for the sniper and we dropped the Hellfire on the compound. But we got ourselves out of there, and because of that I got sent back to brigade and got fucking debriefed by the brigade commander.
Well, listen, the lads got out alive, so...
Yeah.
Fuck them.
And I got promoted to sergeant. So I got promoted off the back end of it.
Yeah.
I remember rocking up, fucking claret and mud all over me and getting some fucking right looks. Why haven't you shaved? Yeah. All that bollocks. Yeah. That contact pretty much fucking ended sort of the tour.
Yeah.
And I came home and I had fucking all aspirations to fucking stay in the military. And, you know, at that point I wanted to go do the Hereford thing. So yeah. I wanted to go Special Forces at that time. So I came back in the April.
Yeah.
Within the first month of getting back, got booked onto the briefing course.
Yeah.
So I booked onto the November course, which didn't happen for me because various people in the battery, I won't say any names, but one of them fucking ag-eyed me in front of my missus for missing a dental appointment. And he decided to fuck me about and put me on various courses during my SF briefing course to fuck me
just
up.
Just to piss you around. And...
Yeah, so I signed off, mate. I was like, fuck this, I'm signing off. No idea. I thought, fuck yeah, I'll go do the security thing. So I set off down that route. Mm-hmm. 2010, I was on my security, like my surveillance and
close protection course
in January. So I did that, and then I started pushing CVs out early. Mm-hmm. So I had an interview with Olive in February, but they didn't have any work at the time.
Yeah.
And the week after, I had an interview with Aegis.
Yeah.
Got the interview with Aegis, and sort of got offered this job. We needed to deploy to Iraq next weekend, Sunday. And I was like, he's like, can you do it? And I was like, yeah.
Even before speaking to your wife.
Even before speaking to my wife, before speaking to the regiment.
Yeah.
And literally had my leaving due on the Friday and I was out to Iraq on the Sunday.
Fucking hell.
So things move fucking very fast.
Yeah, yeah.
I went out as an SRT, which is a security reconstruction team. They sort of... like a recce element for the security teams. Mm-hmm. So once the 6 months came to an end, I jumped onto another project down south in Basra for the oil and gas. Jumped on that. Americans pulled out. Things just got shit. It's fucking boring. So I decided to fucking look elsewhere. So I got a tip off by Danny Agus.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, get your CV into these. It was Global. Mm. So I took my CV into Global. Yeah, we're interested. When can you deploy? I got to them in January 2012.
Yeah.
So I got to Afghan 2012, and it was fucking freezing. I remember getting off the flight, and it was fucking freezing. There was snow everywhere in Kabul.
Yeah.
It was just good being, you know, around good people. Mm-hmm. I remember all the Global teams, like it was 50-50 split Yank and Brit. And it was just fucking epic.
Yeah, it's good crack, good banter, good blokes, good operators.
And then after that, I came back and I landed a position down in Wardak.
Yep.
So I went down to Wardak province.
Quite a busy place, wasn't it?
Say again?
Quite a busy place at the time, quite kinetic.
It was. It was very, very kinetic down that way. Mm. We were situated in Fob Airborne. Mm-hmm. It was just the fucking... food was epic, the gym was
good.
Yeah, 24-hour gyms, like fucking accommodation with single man rooms, internet. And up in Wardak, the winter, like the snow was ridiculous, you couldn't move. Mm. So the winter was just like, everyone had like linked all the rooms up with Xboxes and shit. And it was just like Black Ops, fucking day and night. Gym, Black Ops food, gym, Black Ops food.
And getting paid for it.
Yeah, and getting paid, mega bucks for it.
Fucking dream.
Yeah. We got some bad news that the team would be moving.
Yep.
After my first rotation there, we moved up to Kunar Valley.
Yep. Another interesting place.
Yeah, very interesting, mate. Moved up to Kunar Valley, and then from Kunar, we became the team to fucking start up new projects, move about and get things done.
Yeah.
And then we moved from there after about 3 months. Moved from them, we went to Logar province, which was fucking even more kinetic. Mm. It was ridiculous. You had to be fucking on the ball. Logar, I think the lads started getting bored as well. So bitching started happening. People wanted like the team leader position. Mm-hmm. It was like me and Al Emeth. I was former Ranger Regiment.
Yep.
And there was a, I don't know, I just kind of had enough.
Yeah.
I was kind of like sick of the politics and
yeah,
whatnot. So I pulled the pin, I went back to Kabul as a, I just wanted to be a fucking shooter.
Yeah.
So I went back to Kabul and yeah, joined the boys there, and
that's when I'd see you when I was coming in and out of my leave.
Yeah, you would come in and sort of we would hang out together and yeah, fucking go to the gym and shit.
Get pissed.
Yeah, get pissed when yeah. And I think it was when the contract was coming to an end, like fucking it was all falling apart.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know what happened to me. I started fucking falling apart myself.
Yeah.
I think it was December the 27th, we're all fucking, this is when like Kabul started fucking kicking off.
Yeah.
To what it is now.
Yeah.
We're all sat down, there's like me, Andy, Bald, a couple of the other boys sat yeah, there. Next minute, fucking the boom, dust from the ground goes from fucking ground to head height.
Yeah.
Pull my pistol, fucking yeah, suicide bomber on the gate. So, oh, we thought it was a suicide bomber on the gate, so yeah, we all drew our pistols and mm-hmm, got our weapon systems and ran out to fucking defend the front gate.
Mm-hmm.
Found out it wasn't the front gate. It had been out on Jabad Road.
Yeah.
So we're all fucking stood around a bit. Some of the lads went out to initially clear it, came back in, and they didn't, like, we didn't see the initial vehicle.
Yeah.
My team jumped in a vehicle just after this and fucking went out to support. But as soon as I came around the corner, there was like two casualties. There's fucking crowds gathering. Like, I've never seen so many people in my life. But basically what had happened was they were heading west on Jabad.
Yeah.
And they were overtaken a Toyota on the left-hand side, which was a V-bid. Yeah. First vehicle passed, second vehicle... first vehicle got through, second vehicle passed, and just as it passed the vehicle, it fucking like the suicide bomber had detonated
yeah,
and threw the vehicle off the road, facing the opposite direction, about 50 metres.
Fucking hell.
So if it turns out it was a 500-pounder.
Jesus!
Andy Round had come out at that point, and there was just fucking body parts and kit everywhere at this point.
Mm.
It did fucking affect me in some way. Well, yeah, it definitely affected me, especially the guy on the back, which is what fucking got to me.
Yeah.
He'd been fucking, he had no eyes, no fucking teeth, no mouth.
Fucking hell.
And he had like mega internal bleed, like he was yeah, bleeding out of fucking every orifice, man. And I remember trying to get him off the back and he was just fucking, he was massive. This dude was like 6'3" or 6'4" or something, and he was built like a brick shit house.
Trying to, heavy fucker.
And you got this tiny little ginger twat trying to lift him off. So I was trying to lift him off,
yeah,
and oh, it was just fucking ridiculous. But yeah, it kind of fucking hit home a bit, and I went downhill a bit from there.
Yeah.
I started fucking taking Ambien,
self-medicating.
Yeah, self-medicating big time. And then the contract came to an end. And I came home. When I came home, first thing I did, me and Claire took off to Thailand. We had 2 weeks in Thailand and my parents looked after the kids.
Did she notice a difference in you?
Definitely, 100%.
Yeah.
So there was a difference. Like, there was definitely big changes there, but it didn't come out until afterwards. And I was taking fucking codeine.
Yeah.
Like, every day. So I came back in 2014. And I, like, for 3 years solid, I was on codeine every day. Fucking just to chill me out. Tried getting a job the first 6 months of coming home and living off savings. And it was difficult. So there was the financial stress there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There was the stresses of what's going on in myself. And like, it felt like my family was fucking falling apart at the time. I landed a job with a well-known sort of equipment company called Warrior Salt Systems.
Mm-hmm.
It was based on sales. Like, yeah, I was kind of like an advisor to equipment, or
yeah,
if you can call it a fucking advisor. Tried keeping it all together there, and little cracks were appearing and
yeah, that yeah,
there,
yeah,
and it was affecting people in the workplace as well,
yeah,
because of me. I was pretty much being a dick at times,
yeah,
but it didn't help. The atmosphere there was well, at that time, with what I was going through, it felt like it was others and not me.
Sure.
And I worked there from 2014 up until, I think I left there in 2017. End of 17, yeah, yeah. But yeah, I left in a bad way, really.
Mm.
So my wife used to work there as well.
Yeah.
And one of the lads, my wife left for other work.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the lads came in. He was one of the designers and fucking said, oh, your wife's been accused of fucking stealing money and this and that. Nobody had approached me and told me about it. So it sent me in a fucking spiral. I was fucking...
Raging.
So I think this was like the Friday and I just never went back.
Yeah.
And I ended up working with a former battery lad.
Yeah.
Which at the time was pretty much the right thing to do.
Yeah.
All this time fucking going through a little bit of a shitty time, went through combat stress. My wife noticed a change in me. She went to combat stress, tried pushing me through there. Took a year to get diagnosed with PTSD.
Yeah.
Medicate, like they put me on meds.
Had you accepted that you had PTSD at that point? Because I think that's a big thing, is like self-acceptance and saying, right, yeah, I've got an issue, but a lot of lads are like, no, I'm all right. But they're clearly not all right. Had you like accepted it at that point? Did you say, yeah, I have? Or you're fighting it?
At first, I was probably fighting it. And then the more I was speaking to the doctors and talking about the various experiences and shit, I was like, yeah, fucking
fail.
There's issues there.
Yeah.
But it's been like a constant fucking fight with myself the last sort of 4 to 5 years.
Yeah.
Like, it's just been fucking horrendous. And then last year, I went through intense EMDR therapy.
Yeah. What is that, just for the listeners that don't know?
So it's fucking hell. So it's based on eye movements.
Right.
And what it does, it files. So the therapist will sit there, and you don't necessarily talk about your issues or the incidents. It's all based on memories.
Yeah.
You'll sit there. She'll like, right, think of the incident that you wanna, you know, go through.
Yeah.
And then it's all based on eye movements. So they'll move the fingers left to right slowly, and then the more you get into the therapy, it picks up, and it's basically a way of filing away these certain memories.
Mm-hmm.
It did help to a degree.
Yeah.
It helped a lot. Last year I did that, went through all the incidents that I had to go through in myself, and then sort of knocked it on the head. But this last year, it's kind of like little things keep raising their heads.
Yep.
Just through people I know and social media, I ended up knocking on the door of Rock to Recovery.
Yep.
Well, they fucking squared me away, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, not dissing combat stress, but combat stress, it took over a year to get diagnosed, and sort of they put me into the NHS system.
Yeah. And they just gave you drugs then, was it?
Yeah, it was kind of like drugs, and then they would give me appointments when they could.
Unfortunately, with that, it's like when they give you the drugs for it, it's just masking it. It doesn't. It's like giving a cancer patient painkillers to deal with the pain and not dealing with the actual cancer.
Yeah.
For me, but you know, I haven't gone down the. I purposely didn't go down the medication. I didn't want to go anywhere near it because I know. Like, addiction's a big thing in my family, sort of, so I knew that if I did go on something like that, I'd probably end up needing to be on it for a long time. And I didn't want to mask it, I wanted to deal with it. Yeah, how did you find the medication part of it all?
So, they put me on 50 milligram of, like, sertraline, mirtazapine to start off with, which, fucking mate, it was ridiculous. I felt like a zombie.
Yeah.
So, I did that. Said it wasn't for me, and then they put me on sertraline, started me off on 50 milligram, and then moved me up to 150 milligram, and it did initially work. I felt good, and then they put me on like beta blockers to sort of
fucking hell
for the anxiety and shit. So I did that, and then because of the fucking idiot I am, I started getting like really bad migraines with it. So I just cut the medication and fucking cold turkey for about a month. I was in clip.
Yeah, I bet.
So I cold turkey for about a month, and then that was only like a year ago I did that.
Yeah.
So a year ago I came off the meds completely. I also stopped drinking. So I stopped drinking, started going to the gym, stopped my meds as well, and fuck, mate, what a difference as well.
Yeah.
So that has helped. But going on to just recently with Rock to Recovery,
Rock to Recovery, that's started by Jason Fox and that yes. And the Royal Marine guy, lad. Is that right?
Yeah, Jamie and Foxy, they started it. Obviously, they went through their issues.
Yeah.
And then there was one of the girls who went through treatment, she's still going through it. Yeah. Lee, she popped up, which we'll go into the brand in a bit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
She popped up to the unit and, you know, we got chatting about business and then it later went on to the PTSD side of it.
Yeah.
She got me into treatment within 3 weeks. I was
wow.
in front of a therapist getting treatment. And the treatment they put me through was IEM.
Right. So was that what is IEM?
So it's integral eye movement therapy.
Yeah.
And NIP.
Right.
Which is basically based on speaking to your inner conscience.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy, mate. It almost feels hypnotic.
Yeah.
And the integral eye movements is a bit like EMDR, but it's a little bit more intense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like
different. It's similar but different in ways. But yeah, I came out of, did one session, came out of that, and I felt completely fucking turned around.
Brilliant.
And that was only like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Like, I don't feel aggressive or angry yeah. anymore.
You're not snapping at
no,
random
I'm not,
shit.
No, like, whereas if somebody pissed me off, I would be fucking elevated in anger for about hours. Whereas now it's like minutes. But yeah, that's fucking completely turned me around. And yeah. I would highly advise anyone who is going through any fucking issues themselves to to contact Rock to Recovery.
Yeah.
Or even like research it and try and get into some therapy where they are doing NIP and IEM. You know, it's fucking unbelievable. But yeah, everything's good at the moment.
Brilliant. But going back, when did you start Redcoat?
So Redcoat Apparel, the idea was formed back in 2014 when yep. I was out with Global.
Yep.
And I wanted to establish my own British historical themed clothing brand.
Yep.
Back then, but obviously coming back home, like without
a hurdle to get over,
you know, unplanned exit from Afghan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Coming home to finding a job,
mm-hmm.
to living off savings, to then having no money.
Yeah, yeah.
It was kind of like put on the back burner.
Yeah.
And then last year, we started it. We started like Redcoat Apparel.
Brilliant. And that's 2018. Is that?
2018. Yeah. Yeah. Started in July 2018.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been going just over a year now.
Mm-hmm.
It's fucking yeah. It's
brilliant.
Booming.
Brilliant. And I do say I wear your T-shirts probably every day of the week, a different one every day of the week.
You've only got one, so you just wear the same ones
because I don't wash.
Yeah. No, yeah, it's just it's taken us by surprise. We weren't expecting the reception we got.
Yeah,
we did have aspirations to sort of have a walk-in facility where people can come and purchase, but
yeah.
We haven't really got to that position yet. So at the moment,
it's all online sales, is it?
All online sales. Yeah. It's a
what's the website just for the listeners to get on? Buy some merch.
www.redcoatapparel.com.
Yeah,
And it's basically based on like history, military conflict, and we say like violence and shit.
Yeah, they are really cool T-shirts. Tom Hardy has been seen wearing a few.
Yeah, I put that down to my missus. So when we first started,
yeah,
we started off with a couple of T-shirts. One of them was Blackbeard, and it yeah. was around about the time Venom was about to launch.
Mm-hmm.
My missus was stalking Tom Hardy online. She was like liking all of his posts and shit, and then yeah. next minute, I don't know whether it was that, but one minute we're laid in bed and we get a fucking order from Tom Hardy.
Brilliant.
And I was like, it's not fucking Tom Hardy, it's someone with the same name.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then next minute it's on the Venom press conference.
That's awesome.
But yeah, he checks in every now and then.
Yeah.
And he's done a couple of orders. We had Max Martini
mm-hmm.
from
mm-hmm.
13 Hours, Secret Soldiers of Benghazi. He's got some of our stuff.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's fucking, it's unbelievable. Yeah. I can't explain Like, words can't explain.
It's good that you had, like, you had a vision and, like, you wanted to do it, and now it's come through and you're doing it, and it's working for you. That's fucking brilliant. And I love the slogan, always moving forward. It's brilliant. Love it.
In like the shit times, I would always use, like, always moving forward. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like, just keep moving forward. Mm-hmm. Like, don't stop. Don't give up. And I kind of, like, put that on the first lot of the our first batch of t-shirts.
Yeah.
And we put it on some of our products to try and encourage others. The brand started off as it intended, but it's kind of like, it changes as it goes. Like, it evolves itself to the customer base and sort of people that you meet, and like, it becomes an extension of yourself, so to speak.
Definitely.
So our intentions are probably within the next year to be self-sufficient with regards to printing our own garments.
Yeah.
So we want to be self-sufficient there. And then within the next sort of 3 year, have the shop, or have a shop and have the brand on a high street.
Yeah.
Potentially in, like, Richmond or Durham somewhere, you know, like a quirky town.
Yeah.
Where we can push the brand. Something that, you know, visually stands out to the customers.
And then go national, shop in every city.
Yeah.
So guys, if you're struggling, I definitely try and hit out to Rock to Recovery, as well as all the other charities and GPs. But if you're interested in Red Coat Apparel, just jump on online, get the merch. The t-shirts are cool as fuck. Is there anything else you want to throw in there? As much?
Yeah, I mean, check out our social media. We're on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You know, jump on there, give us a like and a follow, and subscribe, and you'll get a discount code for the products as well.
Well, dude, thanks you for coming on. Really appreciate it. It's been great. All I'll say is until Valhalla, brothers. Look after yourselves, and if you're struggling, reach out. Thanks, dude. Appreciate it.
Cheers, guys.
Bye-bye.